Hi guys. Thank you for the beautiful introduction. It's nothing big at all. I'm gonna talk about eating disorders, but we're barely gonna scratch the surface. So we're just gonna talk about like the bare minimum. So if you guys have any more specific questions, please like feel free to talk to me outside of this or to ask here if you're comfortable. But we're just gonna basically, it's Eating Disorders 101, just like talking about the facts. I'm gonna share some statistics and the most common diagnoses or types of eating disorders. You can't hear me? Can you guys hear me? Yes? Okay.
If you want, I can make a mic stand. So you don't
I can hold it. Whatever that.
No, it's okay. I'm okay.
I can hold it.
No,
I'll hold it. okay. So, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, one God. Amen. Okay. So, when we talk about eating disorders, there's actually four main types that you guys might be familiar with or might have heard some of these names. So, anorexia nervosa is the most common one. So, there's anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, and then the last one is the most one that's not heard of a lot. It's avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. So we're gonna talk about how all of these present and like what types of symptoms or things to look out for. So anorexia nervosa is unhealthy low body weight. So there's of course certain criteria that someone would have to meet this type of diagnosis. Thank you. And the low body weight is actually one of the main components. So it's major restriction of food intake. It's not just skipping breakfast. It's not just skipping one meal. It's not just skipping two meals. It's extreme restriction that could result in a very low body weight. When we talk about also eating disorders, a lot of the times we're talking about life or death. So eating disorders is actually the number one leading cause of death in mental health. So it is a mental illness as well as a physical illness as well. But back to anorexia, so there's also an intense fear of gaining weight. So the person might be restricting their food because they don't want to gain weight. So there's a body image piece attached to that. And then there's also a view of weight and shape that is not realistic. So we're gonna touch on like body dysmorphia and how that presents. Okay. The second most common type is the bulimia nervosa. So bulimia nervosa is episodes of binging. So binging isn't just eating past, like instead of 5 Oreos, you have 6 Oreos. That's not binging. So binging is when you feel out of control, when the person actually feels out of control while they're eating and they eat a large amount of food in a short amount of time. With bulimia nervosa, it has to be associated with purging after the binging. So both have to coincide together. You can't just have the binging without the purging. So purging is usually by vomiting, but there's other forms of purging that someone might use. Binging does involve eating food, sometimes an extreme large amount in a short period of time, like I said. And then also the person might be limiting themselves of their food throughout the day. So a lot of the times people won't eat the entire day, someone who's struggling with this, and then they'll binge at night. And it's usually junk food because that's, if you're restricting your body of food, it wants the quick caloric like intake of high sugar, high fat. That's what your body needs. So that's why it tends to be junk food, or like what you call junk food. Binge eating disorder is another type. So binge eating disorder involves eating a large amount of food in a short amount of time. This does not include the purging. So that's why it's its own diagnosis. When binging, the person might feel like there's no control over what they're eating, but the binging is not followed by purging. And then after a binge, someone might feel guilt, shame, disgust, like how could I do this? Binge eating is actually the most common type of eating disorder in the United States. It takes over anorexia and bulimia combined. It's 3 times more than both of those disorders combined. And then the last one that I said it's not as common or it's not as heard of is the avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. So this is actually seen among younger children. And it's not just being a picky eater. It's extreme limitation of eating or not eating certain foods. And usually the person might not be eating the food because they're not interested in the texture, the color, the taste, the smell. So it's a lot of sensory. It has nothing to do with body image. It has nothing to do with how I look or how I feel about how I look. So that's why it's most common in little kids. Any questions so far? Okay. I'm gonna share some statistics. So according to the World Health Organization, approximately 14 million individuals worldwide, including 3 million children and adolescents, grapple with an eating disorder. A study from 2023 indicated that up to 22% of children and adolescents are currently struggling with disordered eating. And in the United States, the rates are substantially higher than the global average. So we're lucky. There's a 2020 Harvard report suggesting that approximately 9% of the US population will experience an eating disorder within the span of their lifetime. And then there's a higher prevalence observed among young adults, and by early adulthood, between 5.5% and 17.9% of young women and 0.6% and 2.4% of young men will have been diagnosed with a clinically significant eating disorder. So eating disorders it's not just for females only. It affects men just as much as it affects women. So that's, there might be a myth out there that it affects women, but that's not true. And like I said earlier, that binge eating disorder is the most common currently in the United States. So let's talk about why the eating disorders develop, because there's a lot that goes in there. So it might be blurry, but there's 3 factors that kind of we look at. So there is a biopsychosocial kind of development that happens. So there's the biological factors or the biological vulnerabilities. There's the psychological factors, and then there's the societal or the social factors. So with the biological factor, there's genetics. So there's sometimes predisposition to someone to set them up to have an addiction or to set them up to have an eating disorder or a mental illness. So you might have a parent that is struggling with an eating disorder or did struggle with an eating disorder when they were younger. So that already puts you at a little bit of a risk or like you're predisposed. And then we have the psychological factors. So the psychological factors have to do with kind of how our personalities form over time. So from childhood, we're learning who we are. We're learning how we fit in the world. We're learning attachment styles. We're learning, there's so many influences that happen from friends, from family, from everybody. So there's a lot of traits that we're developing. Some of the traits that you might see in someone who might struggle with an eating disorder, again, this is not like if someone is sensitive or perfectionistic or they have a fear of growing up or maturing, that doesn't mean they're gonna definitely develop an eating disorder. But it's one of the pieces that plays a role into kind of this storm that comes together. And then we have the societal influences or the social influences. So these are diet talk. So you go outside and you look at billboards or commercials or ads, and they're promoting the newest diet or like what's in right now, and it's associated with happiness. Or if you're in a certain body size, then you're definitely going to be successful, you're definitely going to be happy. So there's a lot of these kind of 3 things that come together to create that perfect storm. And then when someone hits a transitional period in their life, such as puberty, that's when they start to kind of have these behavioral changes. They might not like how they look. They might look in the mirror and say, I don't like how I look, so I'm gonna do something about it. And then what happens is they start actually getting praise for the weight loss. So if someone drops weight, they see their friends or they see someone and they're like, oh my God, you look great. Like, what did you do? So they take that piece and they're like, okay, I did something right. This person might have not felt accomplished before this comment, right, or this praise. And now they take, even though the person might be saying it without any bad intention, they'll take it and say, okay, this is what I'm gonna hold on to. This is my identity now. So there is a really awful cycle that happens, and then it's really, really hard to interrupt it once it develops. And the person might not even realize that they're in this cyclical eating disorder until it's really, really apparent. Any questions? Because I know this was a lot, and this is like the bulk of the talk. Okay. Oh, yeah.
What makes it like an eating, like the binging one, where it's just like eating a lot of food, but there's no purging? I'm trying to think of how to phrase the question. What makes that different than, like, if someone does the same exact thing? They eat the same amount of food, but it's not an eating disorder. Is it because they don't, like, they have control? Or, like, what makes it an eating disorder versus just a regular person who just goes nuts and eats 100 eggs?
So it has to do with, is it debilitating? So the number one factor before we diagnose, we use something called the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. That's how we come up with diagnosis, and you have to come up, there's like certain criteria that the person has to meet. So the first and foremost is, okay, you met all of these things, but is it debilitating? Is it getting in the way of your life? And that's the main question is, yes, it's a loss of control, but is it getting in the way? Are you not functioning on a daily basis because of this? Is it getting in the way of you going to school, you going to work, you hanging out with people, you having friends? A lot of the times people will be too embarrassed to go out to eat because they're gonna have an episode. So it's about the functioning. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are eating disorders usually correlated with like emotions? Like what you're stress eating or like you're anxious about something, that's what you're binging?
Not necessarily. Eating disorders are a lot more complex than I feel sad, I'm gonna eat ice cream. Right? It's a lot more complicated than that. That's why we talk about like all of these behavioral and these different factors that go into it, because it's not just situational, right? There's a lot of negative thoughts that come up, and there's a lot of things that go on in the person's brain of, I really dislike myself. And there's a lot of also distorted thinking and distorted views of who they are.
Are there like early signs of an eating disorder that you can like that somebody can catch before it like it's like labeled or like developed an actual eating disorder?
Yes. Yes. The question was: are there early signs for someone to detect if someone in your life is or you is struggling with an eating disorder? And there are. So eating disorders, like any other addiction, it has a lot to do with sneakily behavior. So someone might be outgoing, someone might be like, oh, they wanna go out to eat, they wanna do things with you, but then all of a sudden they stop. And it's because they wanna use behaviors or they wanna restrict. So there's a lot of behavior, there's a ton of behaviors that someone could be on the lookout for. And it mostly has to do with fear of like the high carb diet food or high fat or high sugar. They might be limiting their food. They might also be exercising to compensate. So someone who might be eating, they think they didn't eat a salad, right? They ate something more. So they're like, okay, I need to compensate. I need to do something to get rid of what I ate. Someone might also be trying to earn food, right? They might be thinking, oh, I need to exercise in the morning so I can earn my breakfast. So there's a lot of the mentality of everything is surrounding the food, everything is surrounding, like their whole day, it becomes a full-time job about the behaviors and about the eating disorder. It doesn't get to that point right away. It takes time to build up, but there are early signs. And I'm gonna share some resources at the end as well that you guys can like look at as well. So you'll know when someone has an eating disorder because it's not a healthy lifestyle, right? There's the person tries to do everything they can to make sure that they don't gain weight. And then they actually, some people get to a point where they want to gain weight, but they can't because there's a lot of like stuff that the body goes through that it's burning the food even as you're eating it, which is like when it gets really, really bad. But it has a lot to do with the mentality of it. It has a lot to do, that's why it's a mental illness and a physical illness at the same time. It has a lot to do with your intentions about it. Why am I not eating lunch today? Or why am I skipping breakfast? Why am I not going out with my friends and it's 4th of July and eating burgers and hot dogs, right? There is a lot of that mentality of why am I doing this? That's when it becomes more of an illness. Eventually it will become debilitating. So there's eating disorders actually influence the most intelligent people in the world. People who have PhDs, people who are doctors, lawyers, nurses even, people, I've seen it all. And it affects the people who are the most intelligent because there's a lot of this like perfectionistic tendency that I can't be perfect at anything, I'm gonna be perfect at being the sickest person. So there's that mentality. It will eventually become debilitating. I've seen people where they kept their 4.0 GPA throughout college and high school, and after that, they tanked. So it's not like someone who's not intelligent or someone who's gonna be failing their classes or not showing up to work. I worked with a nurse who she worked the entire time she had her eating disorder and nobody knew. So it's more of like a hidden disorder. So the defining characteristic of a mental illness is this lost perspective, right? So the person might not have a basis in what they're hearing, seeing, thinking, or feeling anymore. So they're kind of out of that, they're out of touch with reality. So there's also distorted or delusional thoughts regarding this, their size of their body, shape, the food, and then themselves and others. So we're gonna talk about body dysmorphia and how that like shows up in eating disorders. But this is really, really important to know that eating disorders are actually not a disorder of choice. The person doesn't just wake up one morning and say, I'm gonna have an eating disorder. There is a lot of stuff that really builds up to that level. So there might be like a really big myth that someone is choosing to have an eating disorder, someone's choosing to restrict their food. It's a lot more complicated than that, like we just discussed. I've seen people where the distortion is so severe where they think that if they touch the food, that they're actually gonna absorb it. It gets to that level because they're so out of touch with reality. Right? If they just look at the food or touch it, then automatically they intook the calories, which is not true. So with body dysmorphia, there's really three hallmarks that come with this. So it's a mental health condition in which the person can't stop thinking about one or more perceived defects or flaws in their appearance. Again, the key word here is perceived. There's this intense focus on the person's appearance and body image. They might be checking the mirror repeatedly. They might start to groom themselves or trying to seek reassurance from other people. And then sometimes this could be long, many, many hours of the day. So this comes up a lot in eating disorders because the person wants to make sure that they didn't put on weight. They want to make sure that whatever they ate didn't go to certain parts that they don't want it to go to. And then there's also a lot of the times, this is when it gets really bad, the person might seek out cosmetic procedures to try to fix what that perceived flaw is. And what happens is they fix one thing and then there's another thing that they start becoming dissatisfied with. So it's a constant procedures of trying to fix stuff and that you think is wrong with you. One of the main hallmarks of most of the eating disorders is chronic malnutrition. So this is a medical emergency. So when someone goes to treatment, our first priority is to feed their brain, is to feed their body. Their brain is in this brain starvation mode. Essentially, the person can't form sentences. They can't make rational decisions anymore. They can't be trusted. A lot of people could be gravely disabled, which means someone else has to take over for them to make sure that they're getting the right help. So there's this brain rescue that has to happen. So let's talk a little bit about the function of the eating disorder. So we know how eating disorders develop. Now, why would someone develop an eating disorder? Like, how does this help them? What is the purpose that it might serve? So it might reduce their anxiety in the short term. It might reduce fear of fill in the blank. It might stabilize their mood. And then it also helps them to just overall feel better. So the person kind of is, if the person is always really, really anxious and they use behaviors, it kind of brings it down a little bit in the short term. It's this false sense of I feel better or I feel okay until the next wave comes and then they have to restrict or use behaviors. So we can't talk about eating disorders without talking about trauma, because they really go hand in hand. It's specifically a high prevalence of sexual and physical trauma. So there's a study that was done of 609 adult participants. These were about 96% of them were female. So there's 4% that was male. And they did receive residential treatment, and we're gonna talk about the different types of treatment. And about half of them, 49% of the 609 adults, they actually met criteria for full PTSD, so post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's really, really high. So I really want all of us to have some takeaway from this, which is like, how could I be contributing without realizing it? And this is, I didn't know a lot of this either before I started working with eating disorders, but I learned as I kind of got educated. So you might be contributing by praising someone else's appearance based on the size or physical attractiveness. So you might say, hey, you look great because you did this, or you look really good in this. So that might make someone think, oh, I must have done something to change my body in this outfit. And therefore, okay, I'm doing something right, let me keep going. Again, this is, you're not doing anything to harm that person, but you might be contributing to the problem. Complimenting someone when they lose weight or diet. Like, oh my God, you're intermittently fasting. Like, how could I do that? Or what is like the newest diet that's out there? So complimenting someone if they lose weight or if they diet at all. talking negatively about your own body, saying, oh my God, I feel so fat today. Or, oh my God, I can't believe I ate this. Or, I haven't exercised in 2 weeks. Like, I really need to go back to the gym. All of those subtle comments, they really kind of build up to something. Discussing measurements, weight, or clothing size. Like, oh, I can't believe I went from this size to this size. Last year, these pair of pants used to fit me. They don't fit me anymore. Like, what happened? Thinking of food as good versus bad, right? So food is food. A lot of the times we put food on like a pedestal that it has to be good for me or it can't be unhealthy. It has to be healthy versus unhealthy. So just thinking of food as food and not adding like any more value to it than it needs. Making fun of or criticizing your own eating or others. Eating, just saying like, wow, I can't believe I demolished this. This comes up a lot in like Thanksgiving dinners, right? Some people might be like, oh, you're gonna go for seconds? Are you sure? So all of these things really come up and like they affect the person or yourself. Saying someone is healthy or well just because they are thin. So there's a myth that thin is healthy, which is actually not true. There's a lot of people who are like in bigger bodies who are much, much healthier than someone who's in a smaller body because of what the person that's in a thinner body trying to do to maintain that, right? And then the last thing is allowing the media or friends or whoever to dictate what type of body is currently in, right? Like a certain height, a certain weight, a certain size, a certain shape. So treatment looks different for everybody. It can be really, really severe where someone needs to be in the ICU who's struggling with an eating disorder. Like we said, malnutrition, it affects the organs, it affects the brain, it affects every single part of the body. It's not just the food, right? Someone can get to a point where they're very, very, very sick, where they need a feeding tube. Because they can't physically feed themselves. So that's like inpatient level of care. That's like the hospital. And then below that is residential. So I work in a residential setting. So it's still 24/7, but we don't have NG tubes or tube feeding. But there is 24/7 support. The person is essentially stabilizing and their weight restoring in this level of care. Weight restoration is getting to a point where your body is functioning the most it can because you've already went backwards. By losing so much weight, you have to gain the weight back to be able to, for your body to be able to function. There is this one, which is a partial hospitalization program or intensive outpatient. This is essentially a day treatment program. So you go during the day for a few hours, and then you go home and practice the skills that you learned. And then this one is outpatient. That's basically just maintenance. So kind of like when we get our oil change, there's maintenance as well for yourself. So when you go, you see a therapist once a week, a dietitian, maybe a psychiatrist if you need it. And then the last step is recovery. So the five main domains of recovery essentially are the medical and psychiatric stabilization, that's the number one, the psychological stabilization or the mental stabilization, nutritional, relational, and then having the support that's in there for you to prevent relapse, because relapse does happen. And then these are just some resources just on if you want additional information or if you want to know more about eating disorders or like support groups or what's out there to help individuals that struggle. Like I said, this happens, it's the most prevalent in early teens, so after puberty, and then again during the transition period from high school to college. That's when we kind of see another spike of eating disorders. Any questions? Yeah.
If somebody like finds or like comfort in food and like it's becoming an eating disorder, are there like similar, I don't know, like things that you can like take in or do that can like kind of replace and give the same effect as like food and the same comfort? Or
yeah.
Is it like up to the person?
Yeah, so binge eating disorder can be a little bit about emotional eating. So part of it can be emotional eating of, this is how I learn how to cope with my emotions, right? So there's a little bit of a component there. So what I would recommend is, if you notice there is a pattern there, is to reach out to a dietitian. There is a difference between a dietitian and a nutritionist. So anybody can be a nutritionist. I can go online tomorrow and become a nutritionist in a matter of a few hours of doing a course. A dietitian has to go through a full school, and they usually have to get their master's degree to become a dietitian. So I would recommend reaching out to a dietitian of just like, hey, these are my patterns. Can you tell me like what you're noticing? They might have you keep a log. They might have you do kind of like a fullness slash hunger log, where you eat when you're hungry and you stop when you're full, and kind of notice your senses and what's coming up for you in those moments. So that's what I would recommend.
You said it's a cycle, but what if it's gone on for so many years and you can tell you're getting weaker, but you don't know how to like break it, like you don't remember what it was like before?
Yeah, so like we talked about, there's this. Oh, sorry. So the question was, what if it goes on for so long, this cycle, and you actually lose yourself in it? You don't remember what it was like before, right? So that happens, because the eating disorder becomes your new identity. The eating disorder becomes your best friend. It's always with you. You're on vacation, the eating disorder is with you. You're in school, the eating disorder is with you. Everywhere you go, it's your companion. So that is true. The person forgets who they are. They lose themselves. And nothing can stop that. There's a lot of people who lose relationships because they lose themselves in the eating disorder. So if you get to that point, that's where the inpatient level of care is the most important. Because you might not be able to get to a point where you can eat a consistent amount of food or nutrition throughout the day. So you have to reach out for help. I always say it takes a village, and for eating disorders, it actually does take a village, because nobody can do it on their own, especially if it gets to that level.
As a like eating professional,
mm-hmm.
What do you think of like fasting, the church and stuff, like how it's good, how it could go bad?
Yeah, I think that if you know you have a history of, let's not even say an eating disorder, just disordered eating, and you might be using fasting as a way to restrict or kind of to limit your intake, again, you gotta check your intentions. I don't think any of the priests would, if they know you and you kind of opened up to them about, hey, these are my intentions, I don't think they would give you the wrong recipe to follow. They would help you. They would come up with a plan to make sure that your mentality or your mindset doesn't change, or you don't use the fast in a negative way to kind of feed into an eating disorder or a disordered eating. Any other questions?
Address that in a way, because I feel like it's a lot more
So we all have weight bias, whether you know it or not. We all have weight bias. There is, if you're interested, there's a test that you can take to find out like where you fit on the scale. But we all have certain biases, and I might see someone who's in a bigger body and just be like, "Oh, you can do yoga, or you need to walk." But someone who doesn't look like they're in a bigger body, I might be like, "No, you need to like sit this one out." So I think with the binge eating, it's not as, people feel a lot of shame to get help because they're like, "I don't look sick." But ultimately, their behaviors might dictate that they're actually sicker than someone who isn't in a, who is struggling with something else. So there's a lot of treatment that goes into it. It's a different type of treatment to treat someone with binge eating than it is to treat someone with anorexia, for example. But a lot of the things we look at is like the growth charts. We want to make sure that the person is trending in the way that they should be. So some people are always going to be in the 90th percentile, right? Where you were maybe a 10-pound baby and you continue to be like that. And that's what we want to look at for someone who's like that. But we also want to make sure that there's like the emotional hunger piece isn't there.
Have you helped like somebody you love, like as just like a friend or family member when they're struggling with that specifically?
I think just to be a supportive person, to not put them on the spot, to not make them feel like they're different, or to just be there as someone that you're gonna like support and see what they need from you. But I don't think you should treat them like any differently.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You kind of have to understand your patterns. You have to understand like your triggers. And sometimes you might pause and say like, okay, why am I opening the fridge again? Or why am I looking for food again? Is it because I'm hungry, or is there because something else happened? A lot of the times also with binge eating, like we said, the person might be restricting their intake for a while. So they might binge at the end of the day. So if you're depriving yourself from certain types of food because you think it's bad or you think it's unhealthy, your body's gonna crave those foods even more. So have a consistent diet, have a variety of food, and be okay with that. Absolutely. The question was, is there like a spiritual aspect that you can use to help someone? And 1,000%. We all have a soul, and when we forget that we have a soul, we just think of like, I just have a body. And that's what the eating disorder is trying to control, is the body, right? And we forget that our soul and our spirit is what's connected to God. And using kind of spirituality, using religion is a really, really important piece. I've seen so many people that's what it got them through their journey of recovery, is that I believe in God. I believe that He will heal me. I believe that He will get me through this. It's a huge component.
Like,
So the question.
Comment on like, oh, you need to eat more, or
yeah.
you're eating a bit too much, or that kind of thing.
Yeah. So the question is like, how do you deal with comments of like, just eat the burger, it's fine, or just eat more food, or put on some weight. I think you have to find someone who you're close with to open up to, and they can kind of guide you to combating these comments or to kind of respond back to these comments. It might be a therapist, it might be a close friend, it might be a priest. They're gonna help guide you of like, sometimes you might wanna ignore the comments because you don't wanna get into like a battle with someone, or you're not ready to explain to that person what you're going through. But sometimes you might want to explain like, hey, it's not about this. It's not about how simple or how simplified you're making it. Does that help? Okay. Thank you, guys.